hopefully if this is working. So probably you can begin by telling me a little bit about your history of engagement with the group of survivors. Jerry told me that you're going to be a very busy person in coming few days.
Right, right. I started, I can't remember what year it was. So it was probably 83.
It's a long time ago.
In the late, I think from 1979-80, I was involved in a group. It was an informal study group of, we called ourselves the East Bay Socialist Doctors Group.
Mm.
And we were a group of progressive doctors who were working in mostly in public sector clinics mm-hmm. in the East Bay. Mm-hmm. And we used to get together and talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, there was a doctor who had heard about these the A-bomb survivors exam, the medical exams,
mm-hmm.
that had been done at the Public Health Service Hospital. But since that closed, they were looking for some people to organize it outside of the Public Health Service Hospital. So that's how I learned about it. At the same time, through the Physicians for Social Responsibility, you know that
mm-hmm.
group, because of that group, Richard Fleming was, they found Richard Fleming, and I knew Richard a little bit because he was 1 year behind me in medical school.
Oh.
We went to the same medical school.
Where did you go?
At UCSF.
UCSF. Mm-hmm.
So somehow we got together and we, you know, were working on helping organize the 1983 medical exams. I think we did it at UC.
I see.
So that's how it started, and I think
I must have met Jerry. I don't, you know, this is too long ago. I must have met Jerry that way.
She was around just around the same time getting involved in the Friends of Hivaksha,
yeah,
as I understand
right.
it.
So
right.
It was right around that time. So I got involved with the East Bay Socialist Doctors Group, and then we just, you know, we did it. Oh, I must have missed. Maybe I just did it once. And then I moved to New York temporarily. So I was not here from 84 to 86. I was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably missed one. And then when I came back in 87, I helped out at one of the exams. I didn't organize it, but I helped out.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow, I think Jerry probably got me. I somehow joined Friends of Hivaksha.
I see.
So somehow, and I can't even remember when I started getting so that I and Richard were the main people organizing the volunteers. I don't remember when that started.
Mm. But when you say then first survivors in the States were getting treatment in public health care system,
yeah.
but then they were not eligible anymore?
The hospital closed.
Hospital closed,
the hospital closed. So there were some public health doctors, I guess, U.S. public health service doctors who were organizing it, and because the hospital closed down.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally closed.
No,
I mean, it totally closed.
Future for that.
Yeah, so that we took over and yeah. I don't even know how long they had been doing it.
Right. Well, my understanding was that there was no American Hivaksha medical free checkups that they can have an access to in the States, whereas in Japan, obviously, they are getting.
This one's supposed to be the 18th. The one we're doing
is
the 18th. So that means it's been happening for like 36 years.
That's right. That's a long time. Right.
So 36 years, it's been going on since when?
77, I think.
77?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So it happened a few times, and then we took over, and then we started doing it.
Mm.
Yeah.
So first you said it happened in UC San Francisco.
It was at
Medical
UC.
Center?
It was at the Ambulatory Care Center.
Okay. And when did it shift over to
I think, you know, I'm trying to remember. It shifted over
because of the problem of Monday, because they used to do it in 3 days. They used to start Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday. And we couldn't, UC could not give up that space on Monday, understandably. I mean, everyone's short of space, so they couldn't do it. So I remember one year we did Saturday and Sunday, we did it at UC, and then Monday, there was one time we actually came here before this clinic was what it is now. It was just a public health site. They just did public health things, and then in the late 80s, we became a primary care clinic. So that's... So, God, I don't remember the years at all. Jerry might have data. I kept things. But so that one year it was, we did UC for 2 days, and then we did here. And then there was another time when we did 2 days at UC, and then we did a day at CPMC, California Presbyterian Hospital.
Oh, okay.
So I remember doing it once, the Monday, just the Monday.
And
it was very short, just, you know, very few people on Monday. And then we just kept saying, let's try to do it in 2 days.
Right.
Oh, and then, no, first, we did it at St. Mary's because John Umekubo was, you know, he was a staff physician at St. Mary's, and so that was a great... That was great to get that. And I'm pretty sure we were happy to do that because we could use their them Monday morning. So there were maybe one or two where we did Saturday, Sunday, and Monday morning. And then they got better and they could just do Saturday, Sunday, which has really helped. Yeah, that's really helped.
Do you know if Dr. Umekubo has been involved in this from the beginning? Around when
I would say he got involved... when did he get involved? Did he just get involved when we went to St. Mary's? I don't know.
I was told that he, because of the affiliation that he has with St. Mary's, it was really a nice link that
But I don't know if he was involved before then.
There might have been some formal contact.
I think that he probably was. I think he probably was involved before. And it made sense. He's a primary care physician. He's an internist right in Japantown.
That's right.
So, yes, no. I'm pretty sure he was involved during the UC times, too. Although he was... as you know, and the way I look at it, Richard and I did more of the kind of, I don't have a good word for it, but we did the more details of this organizing, and he was sort of more of a you know, overall planning. But
you did it more.
Richard and I took care of, you know, all the letters, the communication, the organizing, the scheduling, and
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I'm just sad this year. Richard and his wife are not here. So
Where are they?
They happen. You know, you never know when this is going to happen, right?
Right.
They have vacation.
Oh, I see.
So they're gone this weekend. And my thing was, what's been hard is that I had a family reunion. I have relatives still here, so most of the reunion was last weekend, and this weekend was not the best weekend for me either. But you don't have.
You don't really have your own life as well. You don't have any say. Yeah, they are coming from Japan, so I guess they have to decide based on their schedules. Probably you can tell me a little more about this East Bay Socialist Doctors Group.
I know.
And then probably it sounds very interesting to me.
It's funny. It's we were just a study group, and it was a time when we really wanted a single-payer national health plan. You know, we wanted something like Japan.
We were still working on it.
Yes. And since we were all working at community clinics with pretty progressive politics, we just got together to do reading, you know, to read the literature and discuss it. And, you know, one of the people in the group, in fact, the person who got me involved, mm-hmm. is the husband of the mayor of Oakland now.
Ah, okay.
You know, Floyd Hugh, and he's married to Jean Kwan.
Oh,
So the interesting thing for me about all this, and I don't know that you'll ever get to this, but there's a lot of connections with sectarian politics. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that, you know, sectarian politics, what...
You can tell me about it.
Well, I don't know about it, but in the 60s, late 60s and 70s, there were some very left-wing groups. There was Progressive Labor, there was the Communist Workers' Party, there was League for Revolutionary Struggle, Spartacist League. There were all kinds of these very radical groups,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I can only piece this together, and people don't really talk to me about it. And Richard, my colleague here, he was involved in League for Revolutionary Struggle, which a bunch of my other friends were also involved in. So there's this whole history there that no one talks about. And what was very uncomfortable in FOH, and I don't even know if Jerry, she probably didn't mention this, there was
really
a huge, very unpleasant competition within FOH between LRS and CWP to take control of FOH. It was very ugly. It was extremely unpleasant.
Was it mostly political disputes?
Oh, totally political. It was, in fact, I don't even know if there was a difference in approach. All I know is that CWP tended to look, as people would say, tended to look towards USSR, and LRS tended to look towards China. Now, I don't even know what that means, but LRS had more Japantown community organizations than CWP did. They had a lot of. Depending on your viewpoint, they had infiltrated or taken over, or they were key people. And I don't know this because I was never part. Although,
it was before your time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It was before my time. And I was never a joiner. Although I found out later from someone in FOH that they assumed I was CWP because I was friends with Floyd. I mean, they just assumed that I was CWP, and I have no idea. I mean, you know, I was sort of an innocent. I didn't know, and I'm sure Jerry was aware of this, but she just didn't want to, you know, acknowledge it, but it was very unpleasant. Because at one point, Jean Kwan, current mayor of Oakland, was very, as far as I can tell, briefly in FOH, and I just know it was really, really ugly. It was so ugly. People were like saying bad things about each other within FOH. It was horrible. I mean, and that bad feeling would spill over to the survivors. Some of the Reverend Hanaoka, I don't know if you'll ever.
Yeah, I just talked to him yesterday.
I think he understood that there was something going on.
Huh.
I sort of recall, and he was very savvy. He understood that there was some stuff going on. It was just, I don't remember how many years it went on, but it was ugly. And I think, I don't know, somehow by the time I was leaving for New York in 84 and coming back, this was all over with because CWP didn't exist anymore, or else they came above ground instead of being underground. It was sort of all gone, and you know. And
so in a way, you came back at the right time.
Right, but I'll never know. I mean, no one ever talks about who's what.
Oh.
It's not. I have never heard Richard say. He would tell me about their newspaper, but he wouldn't talk about. Being a part of League for Revolutionary Struggle. He probably wasn't anymore. And a lot of Japantown, a lot of Asian politics were, you know, somehow there was an intersection with these very sectarian left groups. And I just don't, I just don't, I don't know enough to really even talk about it, but I just know that I was aware of something going on, but many people weren't even aware that it was going on. I am fascinated by groups,
right?
And
yeah.
Especially when they're ideological and their people are fanatic about things.
Uh-huh.
And so I've always, like, you know, stayed around long enough to find out about them, but wasn't going to get involved.
Right, right. So your sense is that it's not just necessarily a problem within Friends of Hibakusha's, but also something that involved the whole Japanese-American community.
A lot of the groups. I think a lot of the groups, and I just don't know, but I just don't.
Remind me, CWP refers to
Communist Workers' Party.
Okay, all right. RIS says...
And I think, I'm not sure, but it's LRS, and I think it's League for Revolutionary Struggle.
Okay.
I'm not positive about those initials, but...
Because
there was another group that I was on the edge of in the medical field, and that was the Coalition of Concerned Medical Professionals and another part of the Communist Party. I mean, it was all kinds of weird stuff going on in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And it was best for most of us to stay clear of it, but...
But so you were saying then you were not really politically interested in this when you became involved in Friends of Hibakusha or just helping out?
No, I was just to help out the survivors.
Why do you think you, I mean, I think you can look around and then in this country you can really find a lot of medical injustice for people who don't have access to public health services and so forth. Why do you think you're particularly interested in survivors?
I just because they're Japanese. I don't know that I'm particularly interested in survivors. It was just that it... I mean, I wasn't going to seek out. I wasn't particular... I mean, I'm anti-war, anti-nuclear, but I wasn't... You know, I wasn't looking for a group. It was just that it happened. It seemed appropriate for me as a Japanese-American physician to be involved. It just seemed like I should do this. It was only every 2 years. You know...
Did you know that it's going to be such a long-term relationship?
No, not at all. No.
So do you feel like you are happy with the way that you work with survivors?
Oh, yeah. I don't do much. Jerry does all the work. Jerry is what holds it together.
She seems to be very good at making network and keeping it.
Right, and she has a vision too. I don't. I just want to do what's placed in front of me. I don't have. And if it's in front of me, then I'll do it. So I don't. I think it's a good. It was a good issue. One thing I was frustrated about was I was interested in, you know, like a national health plan, and if we had a national health plan, the survivors wouldn't have to worry about health care because everyone would have it. But it was frustrating because the survivors did not want to be political at all because they were worried. They were too scared to... They didn't want to make any political statement at all.
Yeah.
So I found that frustrating because I wanted to fight for single-payer national health plan.
And
they didn't want to say anything. It was totally non-political. I thought that was I found that frustrating, but yeah, that's the way it was. It's okay.
Yeah, but it is frustrating.
Yeah.
And especially given the fact that the Japanese government started to give Japanese survivors, and an American government supposedly was able to do the same for American survivors because many of them are American citizens.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I understand that in 1970s there was a lot of struggle to get the governmental recognition.
Yeah.
Do you think
that's
sort of American, unique American environment for American survivors kind of contributed to your engagement with them?
Yeah, because it sort of fit in with the fact that I thought that everyone should get health care. I mean, I work here, and we take care of the people without insurance. You know, we totally just take care of the poor. And that's what I've done. My whole career has been taking care of, you know, the underserved. So,
Do you think it's a unique gratification, satisfaction, pleasure, I don't know how you can refer to it, but I think when the people get involved in volunteer work or social justice causes, it's a give and take. So you give things for people and then you take pleasure out of your work and whatever that comes out of it. Do you think the satisfaction part for you when you work with survivors is unique because of the fact that they are survivors, nobody else.
I really feel that they've been through a lot. I think it was very, very, the experience had to have been extremely traumatic and frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And as a group, they are so appreciative
mm-hmm.
of all the work that, all the help that we give them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very appreciative. And I'm used to patients who are, you know, and aren't like that. So it was
mm-hmm.
really nice to you know, spend the weekend with them.
Right.
And they're patient and they well behaved and they say thank you, you know, whereas we have all these patients, no, where's my blah blah blah, you know.
Right.
So it's a nice change.
Mm.
It's a nice change. My and every time I finish, and then I love what I've always enjoyed is I've enjoyed working with the Japanese doctors. Because
mm-hmm.
They're different. They're a trip, you know, they're just and so every time at the end of it I say, I'm going to learn Japanese so the next time they come I can speak Japanese. And I never do it. I've tried many times, but I've not ever succeeded in learning Japanese.
Well, speaking of Japanese doctors, though, do you think them? I was actually asking, I was present at the press conference
mm-hmm.
this morning and I heard Dr.
Yamagida
spoke about
uh-huh.
The history of
uh-huh.
His involvement. And I was thinking, looking around the room, and I noticed that there are middle-aged doctors, Japanese doctors from Hiroshima, but younger doctors as well.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering what motivates them to choose to come.
From what I gather, they're always told, whenever you ask them, they're told that usually the doctors is a bunch of younger ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually two or three older ones,
mm-hmm.
and the rest are really young. And
right.
you say, why are you here? And they said, my boss told me to come.
Oh.
So I have the feeling that in Japan, you know, whoever's the professor, who's ever
right.
the medical professor,
right.
tells whoever he wants,
mm-hmm.
you're going on this trip.
Well, so then what about the senior professor's motivation to...
Well, that may be their area of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it's a great trip. They get to go shopping. I mean...
It's San Francisco. That's
absolutely.
After all,
I mean,
one of the destinations.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, they go when they're not working, and they work really hard
uh-huh.
when they're working. They're going shopping.
They do.
They're shopping. And
I'm sold about it.
Oh.
But I'm sure they do.
They work really hard, but.
Now, do they come with their own family members, or
no,
do they just come?
So you know, initially they used to come for 4 weeks. One team
right.
would do all
four locations,
cities. But then
right.
and that was extremely tiring. I think very stressful on the families.
Right.
So then they split it into two. They made it 2 weeks.
Uh huh.
Made 2 weeks.
Do you know anything about how Hiroshima and Nagasaki prefectures medical associations might do different kinds of work? I know
I don't
at
know.
This time. Do you mostly work with Hiroshima team then?
They're mostly from Hiroshima.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I heard that actually Yanagira was saying that there is a medical association who sends out a team of doctors to South Korea, and he was also in North Korea for 12.
Well, there's a group that goes to South America.
Right. That's
yeah.
right. Yeah. And
so
but
it's
it started
group.
Out. Yeah.
It's another
yeah.
group.
So it looks like there are numerous groups
yeah,
that are working outside of the
yeah.
Japanese government.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of different, because when I did that, I did a training in Hiroshima in 1996,
mm-hmm.
that high care thing.
Right, yeah.
And they took me all over the city to meet all these different people that were doing so-called research about radiation effects.
Mm-hmm. How did you find it, too? I mean, did you find it effective?
I didn't learn. I didn't.
Mm.
You know, the point was for us to then be able to take over and, you know, see survivors. And,
right, in the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think the survivors would have been interested in seeing me. Number one, I don't speak Japanese.
Mm.
Number two, I don't have the experience and expertise behind me that they would get as much comfort talking to me as they would from a young doctor from Hiroshima. You know, they just wouldn't. So it basically, you could look at it as a waste, but it was a nice experience for me.
Because
I don't think I wasn't able to use it. And especially I couldn't use it because in my system, I see the poor who are not Japanese. The Japanese,
right.
We have a few Japanese patients, young
uh-huh.
women, you know, young women who have babies here, they're single mothers, or they have American fathers who aren't really there. Those are our patients, but not A-bomb survivors.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. So you don't actually get involved as a physician in the medical health checkup?
No. Mm. No. I had one patient for a while until she turned 65 and got Medicare, who was
right.
my patient here.
Uh-huh. But it was through this clinic rather than...
Yeah, because she didn't have
survivors.
Health insurance. She didn't have health insurance, so
that's right.
I saw her.
Uh-huh.
But, no, I don't know.
Mm.
We tried doing some follow-up. Like, we offered... Richard and I offered ourselves for consultations
mm-hmm.
with the survivors if they were interested in.
Right.
They weren't... There wasn't much call for that. You
uh-huh.
know? They're
uh-huh.
just...
Do you think it's mostly American survivors group trying to get assistance or collaboration from Japanese physicians, or Japanese physicians trying to help out American survivors?
I don't know. I think that the survivors here are very, they really want this.
Mm-hmm.
I know they really want it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Americans, the Japanese say that they're doing is a humanitarian
right.
thing to do.
Right.
But they are also collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
They're also, this is part of their, they collect data on this.
Uh-huh.
So they get something out of it beyond the humanitarian,
right.
I think.
Right. So it's
yeah.
a research.
But they stress the humanitarian aspect.
They
of
do.
It.
Hmm.
It's a huge visit. I mean, they, you know, their suitcases, all the stuff they bring.
Mm.
You know, but I've seen them also have a very good time.
Hmm.
You know, they. I think, you know, I don't know everything because I don't speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes they have a good time with each other,
uh-huh.
and they have some good meals.
Uh-huh.
I've gone out. I've been invited along with them to these celebratory, you know, end of the exam dinner, and you know, without the survivors, you know, not with the survivors, only me or somebody else, you know.
Mm.
And it's informal. Like it's like I'm one of the guys because I've been around so long.
Mm-hmm.
I went to one in Hawaii. I was visiting relatives in Hawaii.
Oh, what is it like?
And
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
And I had already done the one in here, but I was visiting relatives in Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
And I knew the people who were in that other team.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great dinner at some fancy, you know, at a fancy hotel. They're getting drunk. They're hilarious, you know, because they were done. They were finished. They had worked really hard. It was now time to, you know,
mm-hmm.
drink and have a good time.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and then they have done a great thing.
They did
and
a great
nobody...
thing. They worked really hard.
Right.
Solid, you know, 2 weeks or something. So it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this kind of thing or any aspect of your work with survivors changed over time? So you have quite a history. You started out, including the study group that you started
right.
out in 1979. It's more than 30 years.
Did what change?
Any aspect of your work with survivors, do you think, or your understanding of it, that this project occupies in your professional life?
It doesn't really occupy much in my my professional life is, you know, is a totally different patient population.
Mm-hmm.
This is a treat because, you know, as I say, the people tend to be, you know, polite, kind, generous, you know, grateful.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, you know, I can't say that it's part of my professional life.
Okay, I understand that part. But do you think any aspect of it might have changed over time?
Yeah, I think I probably got to know some of them more, and it's always interesting for me
mm-hmm.
to learn about other cultures. Now, I find the Japanese-born people really interesting.
Hmm.
I know there's some in the Bay Area, sometimes the born-in-Japan people and us, you know, Nisei and Sansei,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing much, people think there's not much in common.
Mm-hmm.
And
are you our third generation?
Sansei.
Okay.
And, but I find the people really interesting because
mm-hmm.
they're just a little bit different.
But then when you can find out that you're not so different, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or if you can appreciate the differences and I can learn from them, that's great. So that's where it's too bad I don't speak Japanese, because the older ones would have a lot to say, but I can't really speak to them well.
Yeah, they feel probably more comfortable in just explaining things in their own native language.
Right. And I think that since, given what they've gone through, there's something special about them. And to see them also on this weekend come together with each other, and the ones who are friends really spend the whole time together talking.
Right.
It's just...
Do you yourself develop that kind of personal / friend-like relationship with survivors, or was it always professional?
I'm not that professional, so it's more of a... I see people at other, events, Japanese-American events.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have a connection with them outside of this?
Yeah, it's just hi. Hi. It's not necessarily medical.
Do you think then... kind of the different version of my same question, but do you think people perceive you differently because you are engaged with this very unique and worthy work? People in Japanese American community or in Asian American community?
I don't think. I feel like the
medical profession.
The Americans aren't going to. They're not going to care about this. This isn't something that. It was impressive to UC or San Francisco General Hospital. My coworkers that I'm more friends with like it because they help me out on this. They're eager to help out on this weekend. And I complain a lot, so they come. They have to listen to my complaining about. But I don't care. I'm not thinking about what they're thinking about.
What about other American doctors, so to speak, like yourself, or probably other third generation doctors?
I don't think they have. I don't know. I just never thought about it, but I don't. I have no idea. I mean, it's just pretty. To me, I feel very invisible about this. Number one, I don't like to be in the public. So whenever, there's a TV reporter, I go hide. And I pushed Richard. I said, you go do it. He doesn't really want to do it either.
Yeah.
Because Richard is a very nice man. He's very quiet and soft-spoken. He's a very nice guy. And I'm really glad that he and I do this together because I like him a lot. But I don't like to be, I don't want to, plus I don't feel, I'm not comfortable speaking in front of anything. So I don't.
That's interesting.
It's too bad, I don't like to do it.
Yeah, but to me it's interesting because it is, partly because I'm really interested in this issue, it looks like this type of work involves a lot of publicity and part of your...
Very good at being out of the way when anyone comes.
Well, probably it has a nice match with the Japanese mentality.
I have heard... Someone said that everyone has a fear of public speaking, but that Japanese American women have more of a problem than most women.
Now that actually it's interesting that you mentioned Japanese American women, and I think it's true to Japanese women as opposed to Japanese men. Problem with public speech. My impression is, so you are a woman and Jerry is a woman, and I of course know there are male, volunteers and leaders in the Friends of Hibakusha or CAFS, Committee for Atomic Bomb Survivors, but I think women are very much present in this whole
Women
scene.
Do volunteer work to a much, I think if you look at most organizations, for the last 3 years I was on the board of
what used to be called the Japanese American Services of the East Bay. It was a social service agency in the East Bay, largely for Japanese American elders. And I looked around at who's doing all the work. It's the women. And it was women who tended to be retired, because you had to have the time. So one of the reasons I did my 3-year term and I resigned, because it was just too much time. I mean, it was a board that required too much board time, I thought, you know. So, but it's the women. It's the women who volunteer. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
And I guess the thinking is that women don't have work that's so important. I don't understand that at all, because women have as much work as men.
Right.
But women, I think that you'll find, just in terms of volunteering, I think it's way more women.
Right, yeah.
It's the helping out. The men feel like they have to make the money, I guess.
No.
But then they want to go play golf. I don't know. I really, it's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting question. I'll have to think about that.
How about yourself? I mean, you being a woman and being successful in medical profession, especially, I actually was talking to another historian of medicine who had a chance to interview first-generation American women, not just Asian American women doctors, but just any doctors who were women who went to medical school, so 1940s and 1950s.
Oh, really?
And his question was mostly about how they might have had a sort of a unique challenge because of their gender.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think you went through some of that?
Yeah. It was very hard.
So you told me that you went to medical school in UC San Francisco.
It was very hard. I had a very, very, very hard time.
How many women students did you have?
We had 25% women. And this was 1971. And it was the biggest, it was the largest percentage of women, except for the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania. Because I think previous it had been like around 15%. And then all of a sudden my year it jumped to 25%. It was in 1971. Women's liberation has started. And then right after that it just started going up. But being where I was, there weren't very many women role models. And the ones that were there, many of them were, they said, oh, there's no problem being a woman. They're like out of it, you know. So it was very difficult.
Right.
It was horrible. I actually cried my way through medical school and residency. And I think it was harder because I don't come from a professional family. My father's a gardener. And my mother never worked outside the home until I was out of college. So I didn't have preparation. I didn't see this kind of I didn't see this around me. And the whole idea of making decisions, being responsible for other people was very difficult for me. I was a girl.
Right.
I think I was supposed to just get married. You know, it was very hard. I had a really hard time. I feel like I had a harder time than most, or I was more willing to talk about it, but I had a very hard time.
Could you please give me probably specific examples of things that you ran into that now looking back on it you think as a challenge that you had to deal with?
One thing I had was I grew up in a very nonverbal family. We didn't talk. And I went through these sort of family therapy research kind of things about, you know, the legacy of internment camps us. And the family therapist, this Nisei woman family therapist who was conducting these sessions, said that my family was way more nonverbal than the average. We were way over on one side of the bell-shaped curve, and that our family operated on mind reading. And my father has a he's a nice man, but he had an inhibiting effect on my mother, who was normally kind of like chatty and outgoing, you know. But he just put a damper on everything. So in the house, my mother became very quiet, whereas outside, she's, you know.
Right.
So I didn't learn how to talk. I mean, I couldn't speak, which is why I was terrible fear of public speaking because I didn't know how to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only gradually that I learned to talk. And first,
right.
I sort of first found white girlfriends who were Jewish or from New York who talk a lot.
Interesting.
Attracted to people who were very articulate and talked a lot.
Right.
So then, and that's what I, you know, sort of, I had mostly Jewish friends for a long time.
Very interesting.
And then I got...
Is that mostly because of verbal thing?
About what?
Verbal ability that they...
Yeah, I loved their verbal ability. I mean, I loved how they could, you know, just talk, and I just kind of, like, would watch them. And
wow.
You know, and then... And then the big thing for me was when we started the what's called the Sansei Legacy Project, where it's a group of Japanese Americans got together to basically talk about how the internment of our parents affected us.
Right.
So when I got into that group, that was, and I was, by that time I guess I was at least in my mid 40s, early 40s, mid 40s. I was that old, and that's when I learned how to be able to talk.
Oh,
in a group, because
wow.
it made a, for me, it made a huge difference to be speaking in a group of all sansei, as opposed to the normal groups, which are mixed.
Right.
Because you know how Americans, they're quick.
Right.
And Japanese tend to be a little
slower. They wait a longer.
I still have trouble in a big group. You know, if it's a big group, I won't say anything because I can't, I feel like I can't think fast enough to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So, okay, so what I was getting at was we had to do oral, we had to present the patients. You do a patient presentation. You
right.
say, this is a 56-year-old woman who came into the emergency room because blah, 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 blah. And I couldn't talk.
Mm.
And it came out, I'd get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be all garbled, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so one nice doctor, one of my nice teachers, didn't know what was going on. Because I seemed like I was intelligent enough. I got into the residency.
Of course.
And
it,
he didn't realize until he was reading my written.
Mm-hmm.
And my written one was fine.
Right.
But I couldn't do it orally.
Right, yeah.
You know, because I was, you know. And I mean, I was very aware of this. It was, I don't know how I got through it. Because I had this African-American roommate and a friend in medical school. And she and I were on one rotation. For a while, and she's someone who didn't do so well on tests. I did okay on tests. But she, poise, her presentations were incredible, but she had all this poise, you know, and I'd go, oh, I wish I was like that, because I just didn't have that. I just didn't have it. It's just been a very long struggle for me.
That's interesting. Not... Only because, you know, usually Asian Americans or Asians tend to be quieter, especially in American perceptions. But also, I was recently looking at this 1974-78, the congressional hearing records to obtain the medical bills to support the survivors in the States. And then the way the survivors presented themselves is that we are the most quiet people,
right.
even within the normally speaking
right.
very quiet
yeah.
community of
yeah,
Asian
yeah.
Americans, because they were, you were earlier talking about how they are kind and
yes,
really
right.
you know
mm-hmm.
gracious
right.
and
right.
Appreciative of your work because they
right.
don't assert themselves.
Right. Right. Right.
It really fits well with what I've been looking
yeah.
at. Yeah.
yeah.
So I think that's kind of, it's all there. This
right.
kind of matter of not being able to speak up and.
Right.
Yeah, having
right,
to struggle
right,
with that.
Right, right, right.
So.
Yeah, it's been a huge struggle.
Do you think that that kind of struggle, difficulty that you had, might have had something to do with your engagement as you know, socialist doctors group? Because it looks like, I mean,
well,
were you active as a student?
As a student, yeah, a little bit. There was. I don't know that I was so active, but I hung around on the fringes. You know, I found roommates who were active
okay.
that I was interested in, so, but I don't think I spoke. I did help out on one publication that came out, you know, for a national health plan. I mean, I
right.
did. I knew the people. Mm. I knew people I would help out, but I don't think I was real active.
Mm. You know, 1970s, 80s, that's when feminist movement
right.
became really established,
right.
and also
right.
Asian American civil
right.
rights movement
right.
was huge.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that as you grew
Yeah,
through
no, I
your...
was, but I wasn't, I didn't feel like I was part of any of that.
Oh, I know.
The women's, I'm very grateful to the women's movement, because I think if it hadn't been for that, I would not have thought of going to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna go to graduate school in science and be a scientist. I wouldn't have thought of being a doctor.
Mm.
And all the ethnic stuff, I also stayed away from, because I think at that time I remember, and it was the same Floyd Huen. I remember he and Jean were leaders of the movement at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and I remember going to some meeting during the Third World Strike and Floyd saying something about all you Asian women with your white boyfriends. And I had a white boyfriend then. So I felt like, you know, I'm
interesting.
Not, you know. Mm. And so I didn't. I was on the fringe. Once again, I was on the fringe. And but now, because of the Sanse Legacy Project,
mm-hmm.
which was started in about 90, I now have Japanese American friends. I always had Asian friends,
mm-hmm.
a few, but they mm-hmm. tended to be Chinese
mm.
rather than Japanese, because there aren't that many Japanese around, and I didn't feel like I had anything in common with them.
Mm.
They were too straight. I don't know. I didn't know. They were either really political,
right.
and I wasn't that, or they were too straight, so I didn't.
What do you mean by straight?
They didn't do drugs. They weren't into the hippie movement. They weren't into politics. Or they just, you know, nice girls. Nice girls, boring men. The men would be intimidated by me because
right.
I was doing something that wasn't common.
Right.
Women didn't do this.
Mm-hmm.
Women didn't go to medical school often, mm-hmm. you know. So they were, you know. So
the Chinese Americans or Chinese were a little different than
a little
that?
Different. A mm. little bit different. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the experience of the internment.
That's true.
You know.
So you mean there was no fear or no...
Yeah, I think they felt more... They felt like they were not entitled, but they were... They could do more.
Interesting.
And I think that... And it was all nonverbal, but I was expected to do well in school.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I was expected to achieve a whole lot. I don't know, but because we never... My family didn't talk.
Hmm. So your family, may I ask you if your family had any relationship to internment camp history?
Yeah, my parents met each other during those years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Where were they at?
They were in Utah.
Utah,
Topaz.
Okay.
Topaz. They met actually during the summer working off-site.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe the pager. Okay, 397... That's funny. Excuse me.
Yeah, please.
Oh, this is the pharmacy. Okay.
Thank you for calling Walgreens. Located at...
Oh, jeez. Hi, it's Dr. Yatabi. Okay, I can't say offhand. Sure. Yeah. Great. Thanks. Okay.
So we were talking about your parents meeting each
yeah,
other.
Yeah. They and because my father was
what I would call an assimilationist. Mm-hmm. Apparently from his father, from his parents who were in San Francisco, they never lived in Japantown.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't hang out with other Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Even though his older brother by 20 years was one of the founders of the JACL, my father was like, father was just not, he just...
From the same family.
He's a member of the JCL, but he was never really active. And so we didn't, other than relatives, I did not hang around. I didn't go to a Japanese American church. I didn't play basketball with them. I didn't feel part of that. I just didn't feel like I fit in. I was too separate.
So wait, when you say your father was not really, he was into assimilation, was it after the war experience, or is it something that went before, went back to before?
I think it's mostly after the... No, it seems to me it's after the war, but I did an oral history with him.
Oh.
When he was a kid, or no, when he was in high school, he said he didn't have any friends, and all the Japanese, he said, lived in another neighborhood, and he didn't... So he felt like he didn't feel part of it. And they went to Berkeley for college.
Right.
And I told him, I asked him, why did you quit after 2 years? And he said, well, he wasn't a good student. He didn't learn good study habits because he was very smart. He didn't learn good study habits in high school because he didn't have to.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't have any social contacts in Berkeley because he didn't know anybody. So he felt left out as well. So maybe, you know, and so his family just never lived in Japanese neighborhoods, and
right.
they didn't send us to Japanese school or Japanese church or anything, you know.
But do your parents talk about how they met? They met in internment camp.
Very cute. So it was a double date, sort of blind date. My mother had a girlfriend who wanted to go out with this guy.
Oh.
And her parents wouldn't let her go on this date unless it was a double date.
Right, right.
So they found somebody for my mother to go out with.
Mm-hmm.
And at the last minute, this guy, who my mother said was roly-poly. Roly-poly means he was fat. Roly-poly. It was an old
term. Here
we
go. Makes sense.
So he couldn't go, and they found a last-minute substitute, which was my father.
Oh.
And my father was on an adjoining block, and she used to see him because he didn't talk to him. He was like, you know, he's like a... social, what we should say, probably socially, what's the word? Social phobia. I mean, he was not a social person, but she noticed him because he was kind of cute, I guess. So she was very happy to find out that he was the substitute double date, blind date,
right,
and that was it. I don't think he ever went out with anybody before.
Wow.
I don't think he
How did. Old was he
He
time?
Was probably 25. My mother was a little old, like she was 27 or something.
Oh, okay.
They were old.
Mm-hmm.
They were old.
Yeah, well, people used to get married much earlier.
I think my mother probably felt like she would not get married. She had lots of friends, but... and I think she was very happy to meet my father, and it's a good thing he met her because, you know, otherwise he would have been a hermit.
If he's very socially shy, Do your parents talk about other memories of the camp?
It was fascinating. My mother would only say that she had a great time, but every time she said that, she'd start having tears in her eyes, which is why I was so interested in, you know, going to the Sansei group. Because there was a disconnect. My mother would say what a great time it was, but what was behind, you know, she would say, what's the word? There's a funny Japanese word, something like kanashi or something. There's an interesting Japanese word that means sad and bittersweet or something. Kanashi?
I'm trying to think. Kanashi is just pretty much sad.
It's just sad?
Yeah.
I thought there was another quality to it. Maybe it's just, but... There was, and my father had nothing. He just said, well, the United States government was stupid. But he wasn't particularly angry, which I'm grateful for. He didn't pass on any kind of bitterness. He just said, well, they were stupid, you know. So
that was that.
That was
that. And he was ready to move on.
Yeah, pretty much.
So would you say when you are kind of becoming aware of this, you know, huge history of Japanese American community of camps, you really didn't hear that from your parents, hearing from somebody else?
Oh yeah.
Who inspired you to think about those
things? Oh, it's because of it was a Sansei Legacy Project.
Mm-hmm.
Two ministers, Michael Yoshi in Alameda,
okay,
and a Diana Akiyama, who was a chaplain at Stanford, they had gotten together and decided that they really needed, it was time to get a group of Sansei together,
mm-hmm,
to talk about the legacy of the internment,
mm-hmm,
and they weren't sure anyone would talk.
Mm-hmm.
But they just got, they gathered people, you know, whoever they knew, word of mouth, and I don't know, maybe around 30, 40 people came, and you couldn't keep us from talking. And it was the first time that some of us were in a group of all Sansei, because
mm-hmm,
most of us, I mean, people like Jerry, who grew up much more in a Japanese American community,
uh-huh,
they didn't have the same thing. They didn't, they didn't have this outsider, as much of an outsider feeling as I think I did. And also the same with the people who were involved in Third World Strike politics in the 70s, I don't think they had this problem either. Or people who grew up in a school that had lots of, you know, other Japanese Americans. I have a very close girlfriend who grew up in San Mateo, went to Buddhist church. Her high school and her grammar school had lots of Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have any of these issues.
Mm.
So it just really depended. I was fairly isolated.
Mm.
And those of us who meet through the Sansei Project are sort more similar.
Mm,
you know, we don't,
so
much more, we weren't, you know, we had all non-Japanese friends, you know,
mm-hmm,
so a lot of.
So in some ways, and you and your friends in that group needed to have a group like this,
yes,
to get together,
right,
and then
exactly,
start to talk about
exactly,
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we were more interested in talking about feelings and not politics. You know, so it appealed to a certain group of people.
Right, yeah.
And mostly East Bay as opposed to San Francisco, because
it's
different. You know, San Francisco considers themselves to be the Japanese community, right?
Right, right.
And if you're in the East Bay or any place else, you say, well, what are we, you know?
Right.
And you don't have that sense of being part of the,
interesting,
of the San Francisco community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, East Bay, I imagine there is no core of Japanese American
community. No, except for the
like
churches, and it's much more spread out.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true to Los Angeles as well? I know that there is.
I don't know, because they have, in Los Angeles, they have, there's pockets, there's areas that have a lot of Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gardena, Monterey Park,
right,
there's certain areas that have that.
Uh-huh.
And most of the people I know are from those areas. I know somebody, though, who was more like me, and she went to UCLA, didn't have any, she didn't fit in with the Japanese Americans, and she ended up in New York and did things totally different, and is, you know, never was part of a much more white.
Right. So you said that you were about 40 years old when you started to join in this legacy project.
Let me see. It was 90. I was born in 48. So I was, I was in my early 40s. Early 40s.
So it started out in 1990, you said?
Started in 1990.
Mm. And where did you get together? Did you get...
The Alameda, in the
Alameda.
Buena Vista United Methodist Church.
Ah.
In Alameda.
Hmm. What do you think that your parents thought about your kind of new interested in this history of
the Japanese
Americans, and they are part of it.
My father would not, nothing. He would not. He doesn't have anything to say. But for my mother grew up in Alameda, and she was part. There was a very, there were a lot of Japanese Americans in her neighborhood, so she had a lot of ties with Japanese Americans. And then they went to camp.
Mm-hmm.
So she was Buddhist. She stopped going to church, and she will not. She said it was too far away. I don't buy that. You know, I think that, you know, in camp it was probably better to be Christian, because it wasn't. It was more loyal. You know, to be Buddhist
was to be
more Japanese.
More Japanese.
And I don't know. Maybe I don't
know.
But she stopped going to church, and then she met my father, who considers himself Christian but doesn't go to church.
Uh-huh.
So when she married my father after the war,
she was sort of cut off from her community.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go, when I was a kid, we'd go to Alameda.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a coincidence that I would play with the kids across the street who went to the Methodist church, the Buena Vista Methodist church.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play with them, my brother and I, and my brother and I didn't like it.
Mm.
We had other interests.
Mm.
We didn't. So by the time I think we were in high school, we didn't want to have anything to do with the Alameda Japanese Americans.
Right,
and
right.
We didn't, he and I, neither of us fit in. And so we kind of, you know.
Mm.
And so for my mother, I think it was really something that I went back, you know.
Right,
like umpteen,
right.
30, 40 years later, I go back to Alameda, and
yeah.
I was going to Alameda.
Uh-huh.
So I think she was really, it was very nice for her that this happened.
Uh-huh.
Before she died, you know, because and then she also would give a lot of money to the Sanse Legacy Project. She would always donate, and
great.
She and my father came to all our anniversary dinners. She got to know all the friends that I'd made, because now
right.
I have a bunch of Sanse friends,
right,
a bunch
yeah.
of Japanese American friends,
right?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a very interesting
family history. Yeah, it was. Yeah, so I'm really happy that that happened. I'm
mm-hmm.
very grateful
mm-hmm.
that it happened.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you said you have an older brother.
No, younger brother.
Younger brother.
He's
okay.
A little bit younger. Not
younger.
Much.
Okay. So
he's
are you
in Pennsylvania?
Only... Oh,
he's
okay.
in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He's got a very Midwestern wife. they don't have kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I never married or had kids, and so,
uh-huh.
but I get along with them fine now. We didn't get along with each other before, but now we get along fine.
Hmm. Is that probably because you, why is that?
He suffered because he was a year and a half younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
I was a really good student. He had other talents,
mm-hmm.
but it was a drag to be the younger brother of me.
Very high accomplisher.
Right. Yeah. So, and then when we went to college, you know, he was, you know, boys, they have a harder time maybe, and he had a hard time, and took him a long time to find out what he wanted to do. And then he was, you know, he was unkind. He was mean to me.
Mm.
You know, he was just mean. He was a boy, you know. He got everything in the family.
Mm.
Do you have any brothers?
No, I don't.
No, you're
I have
lucky.
An older sister.
But, you know, the Japanese boy is a Japanese-American prince. They
uh-huh.
get everything.
Uh-huh.
And so he got everything in the family. I mean, I had to just accommodate to his what he needed.
Mm-hmm.
Or what he needed. So I, you know, it was kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
But, and he rubbed it in for, he was, maybe he was unhappy, frustrated, whatever, but I didn't want to go near him because he would upset me too much.
Mm.
So I liked his wife. That was fine. I liked his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only been in the last 15 years that I've now had the opportunity to you know, spend time with him without his wife, and so
mm-hmm.
I get to know him.
Mm.
And I really like him.
That's interesting.
I mean, so in the last 15 years,
uh-huh.
I really enjoy him. Plus,
mm.
my father requires 24-hour care now. And he doesn't come out enough, but he comes. And I'm really glad he's around. And we just had a family reunion. And yeah, I like him a lot.
Yeah.
No, I like him a lot.
Why do you think that changed? I mean, it looks like it's all positive changes.
Because he's not what he was when he was 20.
Mm.
You know.
And you are not either.
Probably. Probably. Right. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do enjoy him a lot.
Mm. Do you think he went through a sort of a different attitude, different kind of, or probably relationship? Did he develop a different kind of relationship with the third generation of Japanese Americans you did?
No, because he was in Pennsylvania. Well, first he was in Chicago. He was many years in Chicago. Well, he's someone, he likes Japanese food, and he would do some Japanese New Year's stuff. He'd go buy, you know, he'd find an Asian store and buy the stuff.
Right.
But he doesn't have the opportunity to have Japanese American friends.
Uh-huh.
Because of where
right,
he is.
Right, yeah. So location matters
right, so
a
location,
lot.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's much of a...
Mm.
It's not in his... I don't think he thinks about it much.
Mm.
Yeah. Where it's become a big part of my life, you know, sort of.
Right, right. Are you still engaged with, I mean, I know that you're engaged with the Hibakusha project.
Yeah, but that's only, you know, really, that's once every 2 years. It's not
right.
It's not a whole lot of time. But
yeah.
But our Sansei group gets together informally once a month.
Uh-huh.
You know, we meet at someone's house, we share, we order out food, or there's other things that come up, like we went to a baseball game,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Mariners and the A's, because they have all those Japanese mm-hmm. players, we went to that. I mean, so
right.
there's some, and, we have email contact, and
right.
we get together. There's a couple of different groups that I get together with.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In addition to just talk about things and then share feelings about many issues, do you talk about some political issues, social issues that are
yeah.
unique to you?
We do political stuff because we tend to be pretty progressive, left Democrat. We just, I don't know if why, but there's some very political people in the group who
mm-hmm.
who actually do a lot of, political work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's several who do that.
Mm-hmm.
Others of us, all public sector kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No one has a lot of money. No one made a lot of money. I work mm-hmm. part-time, so I'm not... I do fine, but
mm-hmm.
I only work 3 days a week, so I'm not a full-time
uh-huh.
full-time doctor.
Right.
But it's very gratifying to talk with
mm.
people, We
sure.
talk a lot about caregiving of parents.
Oh.
Because that's, I think that Asians tend to feel a lot of obligation to take care of their parents.
Of course.
Japanese.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's
yeah.
a lot of that talk.
Mm-hmm. What are the other particular issues that you talk about?
Probably a lot of people feel discriminated in the workplace, or they feel like they get harassed because they're Asian. Now, I work in a place, this clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, everyone's part-time except for the medical director.
Mm-hmm.
We are all women. We have one very part-time male, an African-American male.
Uh-huh.
But this clinic has traditionally been mostly women,
uh-huh.
which really helps.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really helps.
Mm-hmm.
And we are, we have a biracial African-American as the medical director. We have a biracial Filipina who sits there, but she's on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
There's me. We have two lesbians. We have a Korean, and we have a Korean nurse practitioner. It's it's not a white-dominated place.
Right, right.
And I think it makes a huge difference. So everyone else is telling stories about how they felt slighted about something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have those because we're...
What do you think then your friends think about you? Do they envy you that you don't have to deal with that? Or Probably has something to do with the fact that this is a public...
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Facility to
right.
take care of poor people,
right.
patients.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to occupy, monopolize you too
much. I have to go to... So did you get enough? I didn't know why you wanted to talk to me because I can't say that the survivor thing is that big a part of my life.
Well, no, that's fine. I'm really talking to anyone who has different kinds of connections
uh-huh.
or relationship to survivors, and you're wonderful.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I have to say that one of the things that I've really enjoyed is the relationship with the doctors.
Mm.
And because they're like, I was very afraid of going on that trip to, the training to Japan
mm-hmm.
because... I was afraid, and I think I had some reason to be afraid, but I thought they were going to see me. They thought I was a lesbian communist.
Oh.
I'm exaggerating, but
uh-huh.
I think that some of the survivors, if they didn't know me, I didn't have a visible boyfriend.
Being communist lesbian.
No, of course not. No, but I was afraid that they would shun me because of that. But
oh.
I go there, and the ones that knew me,
mm-hmm.
were so welcoming, and they kept saying things like, "That's Dr. So and so. He was in the student demonstrations of the 70s," and I felt like they were really making a point to tell me that they were in, sort of student demonstrations, anti-war
right.
stuff, anti-nuclear stuff,
uh-huh.
All this, and they
yeah.
were just great to me.
Yeah,
they were really great to me.
Mm. So there is a sort of a solidarity
yeah.
connections
yeah.
that
and
you
so
are willing to make.
Right, so they've
yeah.
been different doctors all the time, but sometimes they carry over, sometimes they're repeats, and they're just, I think of Japanese businessmen here, I don't like them, they're like, they're
Very macho.
Very macho, very entitled, and you know, you don't want to be around them. And I was afraid that it would be like that.
Yeah.
In Japan, but what I learned was, and the doctors here, the older ones, or especially years ago, very formal, stiff.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found, what I learned was, and you go to their country,
mm-hmm.
and everything is in their language,
mm-hmm.
it's totally different.
Because
when you can speak your own language,
that's very different.
You can be so much more comfortable
right.
and human,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
So it was a really good lesson for me that, you know, to not make judgments on somebody speaking
right.
English,
right.
you know,
right.
and what their personality was, because they were totally different.
Right.
They were totally different in Japan.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when I talk to survivors, I do it in English, and other times I talk
in
Japanese as well. And sometimes it kind of goes back and forth, and, you know, first part of the interview might be in English, and then after a while it might be in Japanese. And I'm really struck by how personality seems to change. The person I
talk to.
Yeah, I can kind of tell. And I'm sure my personality
seems
to be different as well.
No, I just found, you know, I go to a quality improvement meetings for our clinics,
mm-hmm.
and there's a clinic in Chinatown that's almost totally
mm-hmm.
Chinese, and it's Cantonese speaking.
Oh, wow.
And the medical director, who is, my guess is that English was not his first language.
Mm-hmm.
It's very American, but I think English was not his first language.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing meetings with his staff, and he found out that when things were done in Chinese, his staff came up with many more ideas on innovations on how to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all fluent,
mm-hmm.
right? They're
mm-hmm.
working. They've been working for years in English.
Right.
But he found out that there was, it was so much richer
if it's
they could
Chinese.
Speak in Cantonese.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's like how mm-hmm. much we're missing, you know. We use a lot of video translators or telephone interpreters with our patients.
Oh, okay.
A lot of, you know, Asian patients, Russian and Mongolian.
It must be very helpful then.
Yeah, you need it. Because
mm-hmm.
we don't, the staff here don't have the time to interpret in the room. So we have to use the telephone or something.
Yeah. Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, but it is. It's really interesting. So one of the things I like is the opportunity to get to know the doctors.
Yeah, well, it's about people meeting,
yeah,
I think.
It's meeting people. It's
right,
like,
And without that, you can't really do anything like this. So, well, thank you very much for
your
time. Is there anything that what you feel like you didn't talk too much about?
There are other people. I've gotten people who aren't Japanese to help me out on these weekends.
Uh-huh.
And they all, you know, they really get, I don't know what the term is, they really like coming. They will ask me, when is the next, you know, when are you doing this again? I want to help. They want to help because I think it's the personality of the survivors. They are really, just like I'm saying, you know, they're so gracious and grateful.
Right.
And I think that seems to affect my friends who help out.
So doctors who are
doctors. Yeah, I've got all these doctors doing height and weight and blood pressures, and they love you know, these patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, that's very interesting. Well, I heard that especially in America there is a sort of an effort through organizations like Friends of Hibakusha to kind of expand the definition of survivors, or irradiated population. So it's not as though you have to be the bomb survivors.
Right, I mean, it could be the downwinders and the,
So, I mean, but I don't know if that kind of personality carries over to the broadened definition of survivors or irradiated people.
Yeah, I can't,
yeah.
That would be interesting. Yeah, that.
Yeah.
No, this is a special little thing with the Japanese and the one Korean guy that comes.
Oh, yeah.
There's one Korean man, Mr. Mark Kwan.
Oh, Mark Kwan, yeah.
Yeah. And did this morning, did you meet Craig Lum?
No, I didn't.
I think he went to the press conference.
Oh.
I'm looking forward to meeting him. He helped out decades ago when he was a lab technician, and now he's a doctor.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't seen him for years, but he wants to work all weekend, so I'm looking forward to working with him.
Sure.
Craig Lum, L-U-M. So I think he's Chinese. I don't know if he's got Japanese in him, but I think he's just Chinese.
Yeah, I think it's good that, you know, it's not just for Japanese Americans, but also there are other Asian Americans getting interested in this.
Well, are you going to be around for the...
Oh, absolutely. Okay, great. So probably I will see you. If I will be trying not to get in anyone's way, because I understand that people are busy running around, but I'm trying to just introduce myself to people who come see doctors, and possibly I have chance to get to know them and talk with them. So I'll be at St. Mary's tomorrow and possibly on Sunday as well.
Okay, good.
So I can see you there?
Yeah. Saturday's chaotic. Sunday is much better.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Sunday, things are a little more organized and it's a little easier.
Oh.
Yeah.